Welcome to the Future Christian Podcast, your source for insights and ideas on how to lead your church into the 21st century. At the Future Christian Podcast, we talk to pastors, authors, and other faith leaders for helpful advice and practical wisdom to help you and your community of faith walk boldly into the future. Now, here's your host, Lauren Richmond Jr.
Welcome to the Future Christian Podcast. Today, we're welcoming Liz Coolidge Jenkins. Liz is a writer, preacher, former college campus minister, and the author of Nice Churchy Patriarchy, Reclaiming Women's Humanity from Evangelicalism. She writes at the intersections of faith, feminism, and social justice, and her work can be found at places like Sojourners and the Christian Century, as well as her new Substack, Growing into Kinship, and her blog at lizcoolidgejenkins.com. Liz lives in the Seattle area with her husband and their black cat, Athena, where she enjoys hiking, swimming, attempting to grow vegetables, and drinking a lot of tea. Let's welcome Liz to the show. All right, welcome to the Future Christian Podcast. I am Lauren Richmond Jr., and I'm pleased to be joined today by Liz Coolidge Jenkins. Hello, and thanks so much for being here.
Hi, thanks so much for having me here.
Yeah, anything else you'd like our listeners to know about you?
Yeah, my name is Liz. I'm excited to be here. I'm a writer. I live in the Seattle area. And my journey, I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit more in detail too, but my journey has taken me through kind of growing up in the Seattle area to living for 13 years in California, mostly the Bay Area and a little bit of SoCal, and then being back in Seattle the last few years. And it's taken me through growing up in a mainline Protestant church, wandering into more conservative evangelicalism as a young adult, staying there for 11 years or so, depending on how you count it, and then wandering right back out. And by wandering, I mean very intentionally looking for something different. So I've kind of circled back to mainline Protestant communities, and that's all part of the journey.
Can we dive into that like already? Is that too quick?
No.
Okay. Can I ask then, because like I'm someone who grew up, frankly, fundamental Baptist.
Okay.
Found my way into a mainline context and I'm still there. But I'm curious, like obviously there's been a big demographic shift. I don't have the data, but I've heard there's data basically that a lot of evangelical growth has been folks leaving mainline contexts. Like, what was it for you? What do you think it is like that, you know, that folks find an evangelical context that they don't get? And that's a weird way of framing it, but does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question. I think I can mostly just answer for myself, but I hope it's somewhat useful.
Yeah.
I think for me, it was a combination of just not really knowing much about the Christian world. I feel like I grew up very strongly identifying as a Christian, as opposed to, say, a Presbyterian or a mainline Protestant. And so when I moved away to go to college, I really just didn't have a good sense of what kinds of Christians and what kinds of churches are out there and how they're different from each other and what things I might want to look for or what things I might want to avoid. So I kind of, you know, was open to the broad spectrum of everything. And if I had known more, I might not have been. So I think it was partially that. It was partially that a lot of these evangelical churches have a much bigger presence on college campuses than mainline churches do. Yeah, that emphasis on evangelism and trying to convert people. I think they see college campuses as this really exciting place where people might be open to conversion or just wanting to be part of an evangelical community and try that. So, yeah, I think that, you know, if there had been some mainline communities who were really active on my campus and seeking out new people in the way that the evangelical communities I found were, that might have been a different story.
I'm curious your perspective on this too. Like what comes to mind for me as well is this idea that I think in mainline contexts we're very open and, you know, non-restrictive. Whereas I don't want to caricature too much, but I think this is fair, right? Many evangelical conservative churches can be like, you know, lacking that similar vibe, right? So there's kind of like a, we're the true believers, right?
Totally. Totally. We're the true believers. We're going to tell you exactly what to believe and how to live and what you should or shouldn't be doing to be a good Christian. I think all that can be very appealing if you're looking for that kind of clarity. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hopefully I've not scared you off here too quick, because usually I'll give people, you and myself, like a chance to warm up here before we really get into it. So is there anything else? Yeah, is there anything else you want to say about your faith background, your faith journey, and then like what's meaningful for you today?
Yeah, I mean, another important part of my journey for me was going to seminary. So after I had been in that conservative evangelical context for a while, I found myself leading in that context and leading a college ministry in that context and doing things like teaching students on Sunday mornings, and then realizing that at least some of them were actually paying attention to what I was saying and trying to apply it to their lives, and which is awesome and also terrifying, especially because I didn't feel like I had a ton of theological training, right? Like I had a degree in cognitive science in college. I had some kind of informal church training programs and experiences, but I think I thought maybe I need to take some time and go to actual seminary and just learn more about this tradition that I'm a part of and that I'm trying to teach others. So that was kind of how that journey started. And by the time I actually ended up in seminary, I was also kind of phasing out of that college ministry work. But I felt like seminary was still a really good next step in terms of taking time to figure out what I believed about things and to read and learn from different perspectives and just kind of sort some things out. So those 3 years were very formative in a lot of ways.
And this is not in your bio, but I feel like I have to give you this credit here. Like, Liz has a degree from Stanford, right?
I do.
And Fuller?
Yes.
Those are no academic slouching institutions. So, I mean, kudos for sure there.
Thank you.
Any spiritual practices you are finding meaningful, particularly of late?
Yeah, I feel like that's really been a journey because, I mean, as we were talking about a couple minutes ago, you know, in some of these more conservative church contexts, you're kind of told what your spiritual practices should be.
Yeah,
like read your Bible and pray by yourself in your closet for half an hour every day. Or maybe it's not quite that specific, but something along those lines. Go to Bible study every week, right? Go to church every Sunday. So I think that moving away from that very prescriptive kind of world and kind of faith has been challenging. It's been challenging to figure out, well, what spiritual practices are meaningful to me now, especially when some of the ones that were important to me at some point now feel kind of, I don't know if tainted is the right word, but just like associated with this stream of Christianity that I don't want to be a part of anymore. So I think that's a long way of saying that I'm still very much exploring that. And I think that I've found spiritual practices in things like walking, like spending time in nature, in reading, especially female faith writers, especially women of color faith writers, reading perspectives that were not necessarily elevated or listened to in those male-dominated spheres that I was a part of for so long. And I mean, if we want to get a little bit more specific, I've started reading recently Black Liturgies by Cole Arthur Riley, the book.
Okay,
I followed the Instagram account for a while, and that's been really life-giving. That's definitely a spiritual practice, reflecting on those writings.
You know, I'm thinking, I'm just reminded, like, I went like 8 years without praying, and I feel horrible saying that in some ways. Like I've never really, really gotten like reinvigorated into prayer again, but, to your point, like, I think it's Jared Bias. You're familiar with Jared Bias, right? Bible for Normal People guy.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay. Like, I think he says something like, he says something to the fact, like, you almost, for some people, you kind of have to like stop reading the Bible. And I hate saying that because like, I think scripture is important, but also like, I think what he's saying is that sometimes it's so hard to get away from like those lenses like you're talking about, that we've been trained to like read the Bible from, that sometimes you almost have to like, you almost have to step back until or find a new way to read it, I guess. So it is hard.
I think so too. And I think it's okay to take a step back from any spiritual practice that doesn't mm-hmm. feel life-giving right now. It doesn't mean that you'll stay away forever. But like, I hate when that gets associated with guilt. And I feel like that's really common. And I feel that too, right? But I don't think that God is disappointed in us if we need a break from some practice and to try some other practice instead, mm-hmm. right? Like, I think God is delighted that we're trying to connect spiritually still, even after all that we've been through.
Well, this is good stuff here so far. Liz is the author of a book we're going to be talking about and around this topic today, Nice Church Patriarchy, Reclaiming Women's Humanity from Evangelicalism. So that's a lot going on right there. So there is. Share, if you would, kind of like, and I feel like this is the wrong word even, inspired, like what low-lighted, right? The book, you know, de-inspired. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. As I mentioned, I wandered into conservative evangelicalism as a young adult and stayed there for basically the entirety of my young adulthood. And I think that when I first wandered into that world, it wasn't at all obvious to me the forms that patriarchy took there. And that was in part because I didn't know the questions to ask, like I mentioned mm-hmm. before. And so it took a year or two before I even realized that this church I started going to in college didn't have female elders. Hmm. Or before I realized that the fact that I didn't see women preaching from the pulpit was intentional mm-hmm. and not just happenstance, as I had assumed. So it was kind of this long journey of becoming more aware of the different forms that patriarchy took in that space, those being some of the more obvious ones, and then coming to realize some of the more subtle ones over time, especially when I worked there, right? Like when you're a woman in ministry, all of that gets multiplied in some really strange ways. Mm-hmm. So that journey of becoming more and more frustrated with those mindsets and theologies and practices that were really limiting to women and damaging to everybody, right? Because the whole community suffers when people aren't free to bring their gifts and be fully who they are and serve in whatever ways God calls them to serve. I think there's kind of this journey of increasing frustration, right? Like, I think at first I was kind of like, I don't really buy into this, but I think we can agree to disagree. It doesn't seem like that big a deal. Mm-hmm. So it was this journey of realizing that it actually is a really big deal for so many reasons. And then upon leaving that space, realizing that I just had so many things to unpack, so many experiences to unpack, and that I was still reflecting on and processing, and realizing that I wasn't at all the only person reflecting mm-hmm. on and processing this sort of thing. So I wrote the book in the hope that it can connect women who have similar frustrations or experiences, and just be a way of saying, like, let's like affirm each other, right? Like, let's affirm that we've had these experiences, that these experiences were not okay. Let's put some words to like the reasons why they were not okay. And let's figure out what are some resources we might draw on to build better ways of being Christian together for those who want to stay in the Christian tradition. There's so much that we can draw on that's not this mm-hmm. patriarchal thing that we've been exposed to. So how do we do that? So those are kind of some of my hopes with the book and where it came from.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. One of the things you write in the book that I found interesting, you write, churches are fully supportive of women or they're not. And I'm certainly, like I shared before we started recording, like I'm coming at this conversation from perspective that churches think they're fully supportive. And as I read the book and as I'm more broadly aware, again, as best that I can be, right, as a dude, like the male and the church institutions, we're not always aware like how we're not fully supporting. So share more about that, what you mean, churches and men in church and so on and so forth can do to be more fully supportive.
Yeah. I think there's a lot wrapped up in that. I mean, to start with the statement that churches are fully supportive of women or they're not, I'm not a big fan of black and white statements in general.
Sure.
But I think I felt like this needed to be spoken and stated strongly, especially into the complementarian world. So I think with that, what I was really thinking of was within that complementarian world where restrictions on women in ministry or different gendered roles for women and men in leadership as well as in marriage, where all that's just kind of expected and baked into the church culture. I think within that world, there are different degrees of how strongly those things are expressed and how strict the restrictions are. Excuse me. So I think I was a part of a church where those restrictions took somewhat more lenient forms than they do in other places. And I was made to be very aware of that, right? And kind of, I feel like there is this unspoken kind of expectation that I am to be grateful for the freedoms that I have and the roles that I can inhabit, as opposed to frustrated that things are not actually equal. So that's where I was coming from with that. But I do think you're also totally right that just because a church or other Christian organization is egalitarian doesn't mean that they've got it all figured out and that things are all actually equal. So I think that's worth unpacking too.
I can only imagine like that dynamic of being like, of being told like, you know, because it's like a, it's really, I'm not sure what the right word is, like kind of a perverse, I want to say perverse incentive. That's not the right word, but it's this real backward thing of like, oh, you need to be grateful that you're getting this much, right? I mean, that's real. That's got to be real tough when you're like, when you can see an inequity taking place and folks can be like, oh, I mean, because right, it's like a both and, right? Like, yes, it's good to be grateful for things in life, but also like,
sure,
you know, I want to live into, you know, I imagine for you, it's like, I want to live into what God has called me to, right? And for many women.
Yeah.
But really, I can imagine really puts you and a lot of other women in a real tough spot. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think for me, especially as a young woman navigating all of this, it made it hard for me to take things seriously enough, like the things that were not okay. I think it made it, because I think there were genuinely things that I was grateful for, in the sense of like, there were ways that that church community was a really good community for me. Otherwise, I wouldn't have stayed 11 years. and there were ways when there were ways where especially particular church leaders, including some male church leaders, really did support me and want me to flourish and want me to have opportunities to use my gifts. So it was complicated, right? Like there were these kind of overarching policies and theologies that were restrictive, but then there were people within the church who didn't quite agree with those things. So I think it made it a little bit hard to sort out like what is actually happening here, and to sort out that this is a super patriarchal place to be, even if not everybody treats me that way.
I'm thinking about this in the context, like as we're recording this, I just did a webinar for my main job, and one of the key talking points the presenter talked about was the importance of a shift from cultural competency to cultural humility. And he emphasized that, you know, it's really impossible to know everything about every culture. So the idea of cultural humility is that, you know, I realize that I don't know it all. You know, there's obviously things I don't understand. So I'm wondering, like, and again, I'm thinking about the context again from my social context as being a man, like, and what you might think, like, is it something like that would be really helpful? Because again, like, I'm not going to see, speaking for myself, like, I'm not going to see all my implicit biases and limitations. Like, is that kind of cultural humility, or, you know, to reframe it, theological humility or whatever, is that really something that's really important for churches and leaders then?
Oh, totally. Yeah, because I think that sometimes when women or other people who don't have a lot of power within a particular mm-hmm. church system, that might be people of color, it might be queer people or others, mm-hmm. depending on what system we're talking about.
Right.
But yeah, when people who don't have that institutional power raise concerns or questions or critiques, I think that can feel very threatening to those who have power.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, if you have that humility, being like, oh, there's something I didn't see before that these people are trying to show me. That's a good thing. Like, what mm-hmm. can I learn? What can we do better? I think that's the response I would hope for. That doesn't always happen.
Right.
And I think humility is a really good word for that. Just to be open to change, be open to the fact that we might be getting some things wrong because we're human and we all do, right? It's not like a shameful thing or a thing you need to kind of self-protect and protect your image.
I mean, I guess this is what kind of makes some theological traditions harder than others, right? And I don't want this to be just a bang on evangelicalism the whole time pod, but I think that's thinking critically about that church context, right? Is there is this kind of like, what would even be the word for it? Like this identity to protect, right? Is that, do you hear what, does that make sense?
This identity?
Like it's almost like the pastor is on like a pillar, you know? And I think that's one of the challenges of that tradition is like the pastor or church leadership is seen as in such esteem as such a holy figure, which can be good at some point, but it really makes it difficult for then that pastor or leader to admit like, hey, I do have shortcomings.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And that goes for egalitarian churches too. And we can totally move into that more because I don't really want this to be a conservative bashing session either. I appreciate that. Because there's ways that churches really, I think, you know, have a value for equality and for justice and for all people's flourishing. And yet can still really struggle to figure out how to live that out because we're in this broader society that's mm-hmm. based on white supremacy, based on patriarchy. And, you know, those things can take a lot to unpack. Like you kind of have to be actively pushing back and actively resisting all of that. Otherwise, that is in our church cultures, regardless of whether we want it to be.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I really liked in the book, and I'm someone who's, you know, I'm unabashedly like pro-church, pro-gathered community, pro-worship. You talk about some of the ways that worship and like the Sunday morning worship can diminish or lift up women. And I thought these were two really interesting examples. So one is like you talk about the kind of God conveyed through our prayer. You talk about metaphors for God, especially feminine metaphors. So do you want to talk through like how you've seen those play out, like maybe good and bad examples and why?
Yeah, sure. I think that something I've just, you know, been learning over time and have found really good and really liberating is just realizing the variety and diversity of metaphors that scriptures use to speak of mm-hmm. God. There's God as Father, there's God as other metaphors that sound kind of masculine, and there's God as Mother, there's God as Mama Bear in mm-hmm. Hosea, there's God as Mother Hen in the words of Jesus, and there's God associated with metaphors that aren't particularly gendered one way or the other, mm-hmm. and so have a lot more freedom to kind of read into them or imagine God in different ways. So I think that's a really important thing to be thinking about as we think about church liturgies, songs, prayers, how are we addressing God, and what kind of attributes do we associate with God that go along mm-hmm. with those things? Because mm-hmm. I think that there are ways that masculinity and femininity are constructed in our culture that are there's a lot wrapped up in there, right? And all of the things that we might culturally associate with masculinity, whether that's aggression, violence, mm-hmm. a kind of leadership that's very much just take charge and kind of, you know, not collaborative, right?
Right. Don't ask any questions.
Right. Like emphasis on like strength and not right. showing anything that looks like weakness or vulnerability. Yeah. All those things are not the character of God, right? Or they're not, yeah, there might be, you know, aspects of them like strength that we associate with God. But if we're only associating those things and not also gentleness, humility, collaboration, some of those things we might associate with femininity, we're getting a really skewed picture of who God is. And then that leads to a skewed picture of who we are meant to be. Yeah.
So obviously this can play out in many ways, from some prayer, you know, leading prayer, pastoral prayer, the songs, mm-hmm. whether they be hymns or worship songs. Like, I don't know if you want to give, maybe it's unfair to give examples of like specific songs, right? But I imagine that tracks, right? Like being very cognizant, right, of the words yeah. chosen, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's really important. I mean, I think at the church that I'm a part of now, sometimes in worship songs, our worship leader will replace Father with Creator.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really powerful image of who God is, that kind of that generative, creative. And those are sometimes things that are associated with femininity, but also can be embodied by anyone, like anyone. Mm-hmm. We are all meant to reflect those things, right? To reflect that creativity of God. And so I think that's beautiful, not because God is not also Father, but because it helps us think of God in a new way. I also share in the book how at a seminary chapel service, I heard the worship team sing, "Her eye is on the sparrow." And mm-hmm. one of the worship leaders, Megan, had taken the lyrics from "His eye is on the sparrow" and changed them really significantly. I don't think, I wasn't super familiar with that song, so I didn't realize mm-hmm. how significantly at the time. But
yeah.
When I asked Megan for the lyrics, and they were gracious enough to share those lyrics with me and let me put them in the book, which is awesome. I realized just how much that they had changed, and how the whole, it wasn't just the pronouns, but the whole sense of who God is was really different in that song and really powerful. And I think as a woman hearing the chapel team sing that song, I felt really seen and really just like that helps bring home for me in a really powerful way what I knew in my head, right? That like women are created in God's image just as much as men are. But hearing those words really helped bring that home for me in my heart.
That's a great story. And I guess oftentimes, right, this is probably a word that rings more true of evangelical spaces, although I think it can be seen regardless of the context, is this idea of platforming or, diversity. But obviously the danger, right, can be in just like a tokenization. So do you want to speak to kind of that dynamic and the challenges there?
Yeah. I think maybe another angle of getting at that would be representation.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really important. And I mean, when I think of tokenizing or tokenization, I think of contexts that are still very much white male dominated,
mm-hmm.
and we want to sprinkle in like a token woman or a token person of color here and mm-hmm. there. And I think that is a lot of what I experienced in seminary, unfortunately, in terms of, I reflect on this in the book a little bit in terms of the reading list that we were offered and assigned. Yeah. And yeah, I think that, there were professors who were making an effort to include more voices from women and from people of color. And yet what that often looks like was, here's your reading list of 5 books for the quarter. 4 of them are written by white men. For the 5th one, you can choose.
Yeah.
You can choose a book among these 4 options. 3 of them are written by different men of color, and 1 of them is written by a white woman. And that's really hard, right? Like, it's better than nothing.
Mm-hmm.
but I do think that that's a kind of tokenization, and it's not enough, right? Like, for one thing, it totally ignores the voices of women of color who are often not included even in that
mm-hmm.
pick your own adventure kind of reading. And it treats women and people of color's voices as a nice add-on as opposed to essential to the conversation and essential to our theology. So, yeah, in the book, I get into that a lot more and examine kind of some of the books that were on my bookshelves circa 2020 and who their authors were and get into those percentages a bit. So I think, we want diversity, right? And we want that in a really genuine way where we're actually hearing from many different perspectives and we're decentering the white male perspective, not because white men don't have anything to offer, but because they only have one perspective to offer, right? Like it's one perspective among many, and we need all those voices to help us get a picture of who God is and who we want to be as a church.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Moving to the context of more egalitarian church, thinking about, I would hope most, I can't speak, I guess, omnisciently, but I would hope most, if not all, majority of mainline churches are a more egalitarian space. I guess I know that not to be true. So most mainline churches, what do you think the biggest mistake is amongst egalitarian churches? And like, what would you want, pastors and leaders of egalitarian churches to know?
Yeah, I think that I would say it's a big mistake to think that all of the problems of patriarchy are solved by limiting or by removing restrictions and limitations on women in leadership. I think I really saw this in seminary. I feel like, you know, you mentioned that I went to Fuller, so we're just going to say that, even though it's a pseudonym in the book.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. It's totally fine. Fuller welcomed women into all of its programs freely since I think the 1970s. And they, a lot of their professors have done some really awesome scholarly work on showing biblically and theologically why women should not be restricted from holding any sort of leadership positions. So I deeply appreciate all of that. And yet, as a woman there, you know, from 2016 to 2019, it was clear to me that there was still a lot of work to do to reach actual equality. And that came through for me in those reading lists, like I mentioned, in the percentage of women faculty. I don't know the numbers, but for me, it was very noticeably male dominated, even though I was actively seeking out female professors. I had some really good ones, but they were few and far between. So I think there's just a lot to grapple with in terms of how does it feel to be a female student there? Or analogously, how does it feel to be a woman in an egalitarian church in this patriarchal world where we still probably have some issues to work out because that's where we're at? So I think what I'm kind of coming around to here is I want egalitarian churches and communities to, I think it kind of comes back to that humility that we were talking about earlier, to be humble, to be open to learning that there's still more work to be done, to be just really open to feedback from women about what is or isn't working or what changes we might like to see. And I think if we're talking from the point of view of like an egalitarian church leader who's wondering these things, I would say, you know, actively seek out conversations with different women in the community, especially if one is a male church leader, right? And kind of proactively ask some probing questions of like, how do you experience this space? How do you experience this space as a woman? Do you feel like you've experienced any roadblocks or barriers toward serving or leading in any of the ways that you've wanted to serve or lead? Do you feel like you can be fully yourself? Do you feel like we're representing God in a way that isn't overly masculine? And just kind of proactively asking those kinds of questions so that women know that our perspectives are wanted and valued. Because it can be really hard, right, to give unsolicited feedback. Yeah. That's not a fun thing to do for most of us, at least not for me. So,
yeah, and like even the most differentiated or calm leader, like, it's hard to be like, it's hard to just like hear unsolicited advice regardless.
Totally.
Let alone be the one giving it unsolicited.
Totally.
So this is really helpful. I appreciate that. I'm thinking, I also am curious, like, as a male pastor, speaking from my demographic, like, how can we male pastors and leaders support and develop females in ministry? Do you have any thoughts there?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in a lot of egalitarian spaces, most pastors and church leaders are still men, mm-hmm. even in denominations that have ordained women for a while. And I think there's a lot going on there, but some of it is that women do experience a lot of roadblocks and barriers if they want to go into ministry. And that can happen in sort of official and unofficial ways. So I think, you know, trying to be a male church leader who tries to determine what those roadblocks are and take seriously trying to eradicate those roadblocks, I think can be really powerful. So I think there's that, like there's those kind of difficulties women experience once they're on that path to try to be mm-hmm. ordained or try to be a minister. And then there's also before that, okay. I think, you know, sometimes we might think of the calling to be a minister as just coming directly unfiltered from God to a person.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes that probably happens and that's great. But I think often the sense of calling is experienced in community and is experienced from people noticing and calling out our gifts and saying, hey, have you thought about this? Like, oh, I think maybe you'd really be good at this. You should try it. So I think that, you know, men in positions of leadership can do a lot to just notice what gifts women have to bring, to try to deal with any unconscious bias or assumptions that we might bring based on gender, because I think we all have that, right? We all have assumptions that we make about what things women or men may or may not want to do or might be good at doing. So I think that we all have a lot of work to do to unpack that. And yeah, just to make sure that we're noticing women who have gifts for leadership and encouraging and affirming them as much as possible, because they might not be getting that anywhere else. They might not be getting that as much as a man with similar gifts would.
Right. Yeah, I'm thinking back to a recent episode I had with Dr. Irie Session, and I think she shares a similar story about, like, people noticing her gifts, her giftings, but like them kind of being like, I don't want to say sidetracked, but kind of like filtered, I guess, into like, you know, you have gifts for ministry, but they've got to be kind of filtered in this arena, right? I imagine you've seen probably a similar dynamic, right?
Yeah. And I think that's something that kind of happens in our patriarchal culture in general, right? Mm-hmm. Like if a woman is super organized, she might be kind of cast into a role as like an administrative assistant. Whereas if a man is super organized, it's like, oh yeah, he's a great leader. He's super together. So yeah, I think there's tons of things like that that can get interpreted differently depending on gender. And yeah, so it's a matter of just consciously and continually, persistently working against those things, those assumptions.
But, yeah, it really requires a good bit of self-awareness and self-critique and like you say, like proactively trying to make space for that awareness.
Yeah.
This is not very philosophical or theological at all, but I'm also thinking like, just like, what are the financial implications? I heard this on like a Southern Baptist podcast, this woman who had started this organization, and she was from an organization that wasn't actively taking a stance about egalitarian or complementarian roles for women in ministry, but was trying to advocate for women becoming licensed regardless of the context, just for the tax benefits, right? So I don't know if you've thought about that or encountered that, but I mean, has that been a situation for you or one you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, I do think there are financial implications to all of this. I mean, I think about the time I spent working in college ministry in that conservative church context, and I was working full time for the church. Mm-hmm. And when I started, the position was an intern position, even though it was full time work. And that, you know, that was fine with me at first, right? This was kind of new to me. But as time went on, my responsibilities increased, and I got to a place where I was basically doing the same work with the college ministry that all the different pastors at that church were doing with high school or other sorts of groups of people, right? Mm-hmm. So I was kind of this unofficial college pastor without that title and without mm-hmm. that pay,
yeah.
right? And I think that that can be a hard thing to advocate for yourself. So I didn't.
Yeah.
But a few years later in seminary, I heard a woman give a talk about similar issues and frame it as an issue of justice, mm-hmm. right? Like when I let myself as a woman be treated in that way, that teaches the church that it's okay to treat women in that way, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't help open the door for anybody else or make the world better. It just kind of keeps me in that safe feeling of not making waves. So, yeah, I think that's something to grapple with. I mean, it would not have been easy to advocate, and it probably would not have ended well. So I'm not necessarily saying there's like a clear right thing to do in that situation, but more that that situation should not exist, that I wish it didn't exist.
Well, I'll speak for myself then and for the men, and that we've got to advocate for women and non-men, you know, to make sure folks are getting adequate compensation and benefits and all that. Because, you know, I'm just thinking like practically speaking, like, you know, clergy housing allowances, for instance, you know, these different type of tax benefits that can come as being a, you know, a licensed clergy person. They matter. You know, save me a lot of money when I don't make a lot of money over the years. So those little things I think are important, and like you said, can be justice issues. Before we take a break, any other thoughts you want to share here on this conversation, on this topic?
I feel like this has been pretty thorough. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good questions. I hope it comes through that, like, this is all for all sorts of churches to think about, not just complementarian ones, even though with the book, the first, I don't know, third of it maybe is set in complementarian settings. It also really goes into my time in seminary and in an egalitarian evangelical church that I attended while in seminary. I think all these things are very broad reaching, and that was a bit of a rude awakening for me. Mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, when I got out of that complementarian environment, it just felt so freeing and so awesome to be in these spaces where women were not explicitly prohibited from anything, which is totally the way it should be. And yet does not mean that things are okay.
Yeah.
So I hope that comes through, but not in like a guilt trip kind of way, more in like it's an exciting chance to keep on changing and to keep moving in those good directions that a lot of churches are moving in.
Yeah. So the book is Nice Church Patriarchy: Reclaiming Women's Humanity from Evangelicalism. I assume available wherever books are sold. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's take a quick break and we'll come back with some closing questions. All right. We're back with Liz Coolidge Jenkins. So thanks so much for the conversation. Appreciate your time and perspective. These closing questions, I always tell folks you can take these as seriously or not as you'd like to. So if you're Pope for a day, what does that day look like for you?
Ooh, I feel like when I think about being Pope for a day, there are just so many caveats that I want to attach to it. I think just from kind of an anti-authoritarian perspective, I don't necessarily want to be telling everybody what they should be doing or believing. I want them to figure that out for themselves. So I do think there's a lot of things I would want to change, in terms of full equality for women, for queer people. And at the same time, I recognize that there's only so much that you can do pontificating from the top. Yeah, it's harder to change people's minds and attitudes, and that's really what we need. So,
hey, there's been several people who have called for abolishing the papacy, so that's safe too.
Which I probably have no right to say as a non-Catholic, but
yeah,
that's what comes to mind for me.
Apologies to my Catholic friends here. A theologian or historical Christian figure you'd want to meet or bring back to life?
Yeah. So in the book, I get into a few different historical Christian women as well as biblical Christian women. And I think, you know, probably the first one that came to mind for me when you asked that, I think I'd be really interested in meeting Priscilla from the Book of Acts, along with her husband, Aquila, because I just think it's so fascinating that they were this husband-wife church leadership team in this time and culture that was very strictly patriarchal in ways that ours isn't necessarily. In a place where that must have been really, really radical. And there's a really cool story about them in the Book of Acts that I share, that I summarize in the book, about how there was a male preacher who was going around preaching very confidently, but there were a lot of things that he didn't know. And so Priscilla and Aquila took him under their wing and taught him the way of God more adequately, or something along those lines. And then and then he was sent out with the blessing of the community to go preach. So they're basically kind of like these awesome seminary professors, right? Like they're teaching this preacher. And there was a woman doing that alongside her husband, working together as equals. And nobody really seemed to have a problem with it. So I think that's just a fascinating story. And she would be a fascinating person to meet.
Yeah, that's great. What do you think history will remember from our current time and place?
I feel like that depends a lot on where the future goes.
It's a dark answer.
In the sense of like what we remember now is impacted by where we're at presently. And there's like so much history that we need to uncover and like relearn how to tell because it's been hidden. But maybe that's all just a caveat before saying that, I mean, I think how we respond to the climate crisis now will be one of the things that most impacts the future in all sorts of ways.
What do you hope for the future of Christianity?
I think just more movement in all the directions that we've been talking about. More openness to change, more openness to re-examining things, no restrictions, right, would be the hope on anyone being able to be fully who they are and bring whatever gifts they have to offer. I think that there are parts of Christianity that are very much moving in all of those directions, and that gives me hope. And then there are parts that are digging in their heels that are not open to it. And I think, you know, in the book, I think I really want to encourage women to feel free to do what's right for them in terms of staying in a community or leaving it, staying in church in general or leaving it, right? Like finding a different kind of church community if they want to, or taking some time off if not. And I think I really want that, like for women personally, to find places where we feel like we can flourish. And I want that for the church in general, in terms of seeing women vote with our feet. I think, you know, the more women leave conservative spaces that are not necessarily good for them, the more those spaces might reevaluate some things, or even if not, then the less power and influence they have over fewer people, right?
Yeah.
So. I don't think that those streams of Christianity are going to go away necessarily. But the less power that they have as political forces and just as forces in communities, I think the better our world will be.
I was just talking about this with another pastor just today, actually, about, like, in the SBC, the Southern Baptist, right? They're going through this whole, I don't really understand the terminology, right? But basically, like, churches that have female pastors on staff can be, like, kicked out of the denomination, which as a former Baptist just seems terribly anti-Baptist to me. But I guess that's another conversation. So it's obviously things that are happening right now in real time. Well, share if you would, just where folks can connect with you, website, anything like that.
Sure, yeah. I'm pretty active on Instagram at Liz Cool J and at Post Evangelical Prayers. I have a website, LizCoolidgeJenkins.com. I was blogging there pretty regularly for a while and will probably continue to occasionally, but I more recently started a Substack. It's called Growing Into Kinship, and I'm blogging there more frequently at the moment.
Yeah, Substack is a nice platform, isn't it?
Totally. Yeah. I feel like I should have gotten into it sooner, but here we are. I like it.
Here we are. Yeah. Well, Liz, I really appreciate the time and the conversation. I always leave folks with a word of peace. So may God's peace be with you.
Thanks for joining us on the Future Christian Podcast. To learn more about Lauren or the podcast, visit future-christian.com. One more thing before you go. Do us a favor and subscribe to the podcast. And if you're feeling especially generous, leave a review. It really helps us get the word out to more people about the podcast. The Future Christian Podcast is a production of Torn Curtain Arts and Resonate Media. Our episodes were mixed by Danny Burton, and the production support is provided by Paul Romig-Levitt. Thanks, and go in peace.